Dave Alvin, and right this second, you're listening to KPFT Houston, Texas.
And now, Houston's only primetime radio program dedicated to news and concerns of the lesbi, gay, and transgender community. This is Queer Voices. This week, Deborah Moncrief Bell has a conversation with well-known lesbian musician and writer Christy Claxton.
Freeing Jesus, I wrote that story in the mid-90s. So LGBTQ+ was still, even in Austin, we were ducking under the radar for our own safety. That character, her neighbor, was, I intentionally wrote her to be sort of just almost in the shadows.
Brett Cullum has a conversation with Candace DeMesa, actor, activist, and filmmaker.
I don't have any formal training as far as like playwriting or things like that. I think that works in my favor because I do feel freer to just, I guess, do what I want. But as an actor, so I did prior to creating my own projects, I did act all around the city and at the Alley Theater.
And we have Brett's community calendar. Queer Voices starts now.
This is Deborah Moncrief Bell, and today I'm talking with Christy Claxton about her new book, Freeing Jesus and Other Lies. First of all, Christy, we've known each other for a number of years, and I first knew you as a musician. In fact, you even played in the KPFT studios.
Many times I did. Yes, yes. In fact, pre-production, we were reminiscing about those days with you and Jimmy Carper. And Outvoice was always so kind to me as a musician, and it's so much appreciated.
Certainly, I enjoyed the music in your Peace from the Porch project, which at one time, Christy had a place out in LaGrange, and it was a house that had this big porch, and so the porch became the stage, and she would have different musicians come out, and she would play, and it was quite a special time and place. But you got to make money for the man, and mm-hmm. Christy has had a career that I had not even realized that she had been part of, which was a 30-plus career. As a middle manager would be the correct title?
Yeah, director. I think that's middle management in most corporate structure, squarely in the middle. I worked for about 12 years. I worked for a large worldwide publication or a company that publishing, e-commerce, marketing as a director of commerce operations. There were things about it I really enjoyed, especially the young people, my team. I had young, most of my team were younger, you know, they could have been my kids, and they kept me refreshed and feeling optimistic. And I love them very much. But at the same time, corporate is, you're not there for the mission. You are there for the stockholder. It becomes soul sucking. And anyone who believes that they're there because they as a person really matter, probably need, this is so terrible, but it's true. You probably need to get that out of your head. The money's good. The benefits are great, but you're selling out for a certain amount of your life. And after I was laid off, along with many of the middle management structure of that company, I was told by a woman executive that used to be with the company, you're just a number in a cell of a spreadsheet, and your number was too high. Has nothing to do or about you. It's about your salary. So, you know, here I am. And as soon as I was laid off, I started writing again.
You said you're a writer and a creative thinker, and you spent your career masquerading as an operational leader, but you never stopped writing your short stories, essays, blogs, and songs. What was your approach in your natural state of creativity to holding those positions and understanding what motivates people to do the things they do?
I have a master's degree in creative writing, and for my thesis, I wrote a play. And this is, I'm actually talking more about at this point, another book that I put out called Leadership Challenged, a Middle Manager Memoir. I've done two, one, or published two, shall I say. But what I had an instructor who actually won a Pulitzer that taught us about premise. And when you think about premise from a playwriting point of view, plays are action, they're active. So that premise is pretty simple. It's A leads to B. And in the corporate world or in a leadership role, you're often looking at B and you need to understand what was A to get you to B. And if it's a failure, if B is some sort of a failure, what happened at A that made that that failure happen? And if you go back and you look at people, because regardless of how two-dimensional people are made to be in a corporation, they're still human. So I would use the same faculties that I used for writing, especially short stories like the ones in Freeing Jesus. I would use that premise type approach to why did this person act in a way that led to B? So really A becomes this why. And if you understand the why as a leader, then you have an opportunity to mitigate failure, to support success, and make a better workspace and bring in some, it's kind of a false sense, but to bring in that sense of ownership and pride in what a person does. And if you can do that, then the company is going to benefit, whether they understand that or not. So as a manager, I always thought about A leads to B. My A is almost always a human being. And that human being, there's something motivating. Why are they behaving in the way they do? Why have they become negative? Or why are they burned out? It could be something, you know, as simple as you've given that person more work than they can handle. So helping them in that way. Or it can be that they have something going on at home. Even though it's not a job manager's job to be someone's personal therapist, that still affects the way they perform, and it has to be addressed. So that's how I did it. And I think that that's the part of leadership. It's really hard. The most important thing a great leader can do is listen. And leaders typically in a corporate structure, especially in the middle, because you're getting crushed from the top and pressured, and then you have a responsibility to those that you lead, it's really easy to stop listening and start reacting. So the most important thing anyone can do in a leadership position is listen, really listen, truly listen. And that's what I, you know, took into that 12 years of corporate work that I did. But, you know, when I write fiction, sometimes these stories are things I've eavesdropped over, or every one of them, they're lies, but they're based in a truth that I've observed.
As I read the book, which I found quite engaging, it's kind of the Southern Gothic style is in there. And I know that that's a result of some of the writers that you've admired. Could tell where there were elements of truth in your real life, but there were definitely things like, I don't think you ever were a pole dancer.
Never. I knew a few. You know, I rented my house to a stripper when I was touring with Out of Nowhere. And in graduate school, my theater friends invited me to drink beer at Dudley's Draw at College Station. Anyone listening that went to Texas A&M and wasn't a cowboy knows about Dudley's Draw. And I sat with, actually, she was a porn star.
Oh my gosh.
And of course I was like probably 19 and terrified, but she was so interesting and so smart and so engaging. So I think when I wrote that, I've never been a stripper, but I've known a few. I think more than anything there, it was someone who's crass, someone who's kind of owning their own desperation because they don't feel that they have any other options. And at the same time are sort of poking their finger in the eye of a concept of salvation that isn't real. And I wanted to write that story in a way that she is not really giving herself any real love or any real respect, but slowly she grows into much more dimensional person as she makes a friend with the lesbian that lives next door. And I wrote this Freeing Jesus. I wrote that story in the mid 90s. So LGBTQ plus was still, even in Austin, we were ducking under the radar for our own safety. That character, her neighbor, was, I intentionally wrote her to be sort of just almost in the shadows, but not sort of like Racer X is in Speed Racer. He's just sort of the dark hero that's waiting when you need her. But then I also wanted to point out that the shallow objectification that created the main character exists within our own community. We do it too. I mean, how many clubs in your lifetime have you been to that people are objectifying other people? Or when they're on dating apps, I mean, it's the perfect form of themselves. Men are, I have this great body, or the pics of that part of the body that only they want to see. And I wanted that to be in the story, that we in our community can be just as shallow and self-centered in our wants. And that's why I ended the story with her feeling very dissatisfied with what had happened and finding that salvation is really forgiving ourselves and leaning in and accepting maybe the less pretty or the less flashy things in life. And when we do that, we find our tribe.
I found a number of the characters were damaged or had to deal with damaged people. And I think you are really speaking to having compassion and kindness in your approach. And certainly they're very Texas stories.
Writing about what I know is the only really honest way I can write. And through years and working in hospice, when I was working in hospice, everybody dies. So you see so many different types of people, from the highs to the unbelievable lows. And Freeing Jesus and Other Lies, to me, first of all, I think it comes off pretty strongly as I am a massive fan of Flannery O'Connor. And as a Southern writer, she was always searching for salvation or searching for a pain-free, emotionally, physically pain-free place, and running up against disappointment in trying to find that. And her stories, they're brutal. I mean, they're brutal. But O'Connor, for those that don't know, had lupus, and her life could be brutal. She literally had to go home and live with her mother and give up her dreams of New York and being a part of the literati. So I really encourage people to read her writings if you haven't, including her letters. I think it's always in the back of my mind, the Peace from the Porch Project, my writing, my blogging, always in the back of my mind that we have to take those blinders off and see humanity for what it is. And accept it where it's at. There's so much beauty that's overlooked by our own sort of these worlds we create, our own milieu, our own sort of environments that we feel comfortable in our bubble, and we're not coming out of that. And that's what, when I write short stories, that's what that's about, is you can be a victim of circumstance. And in most cases, that's what these characters are. They're a victim of circumstance, and then they have a choice on what to do about that. And the irony is that I was a victim of really my own circumstance by working for so many years in corporate America and not really doing anything about that when I could have. It's just something as shallow for me as I was making a hell of a lot of money, and I had these great benefits, and it gave my wife and I the good life. But really, was it a good life? And I think the question is here is, when you read Freeing Jesus, is, are these the good life, or do these feel like a life that we're all living? And it's a choice.
I think my favorite story is where the young offender who's doing community service work as part of his sentencing kidnaps his former third grade teacher, who's in the, you describe it as an old folks home, and takes her on a motorcycle ride.
Yes, yes. And that story, I mean, society is so down on him. And even though she enjoys this adventure with him and his buddies, he is still looked down upon. He's not going to be forgiven for what he's done, because people have already set their minds on who he is. And that's all they see is the offender, and don't see the human being underneath that. And that was, I wish I could remember, Deb, when I wrote that, why I wanted to write something like that. But there must have been some sort of a writing prompt or something that asked writers to write a story about their favorite teacher or something. And I wanted to write a story about the people who we look at and say, there's no way that person had a favorite teacher. It's a wonder they got out of school in the first place. So, you know, she was able to affect him in a positive way, even though it was late in her life and he's a full grown adult, versus the stories we always see in social media and TV about the doctor who was poor, whose teacher didn't realize that she's the reason he's a doctor. Otherwise, you know, he would have been living on the streets kind of story. Well, what about the rest? So that's what that story's about. What about everybody else?
Yeah, I think it was an homage to those special teachers that we, many of us, at least I was, fortunate to have, that touched our lives and inspired us and were offered a guidance to where our life would go. And I felt like you must have had a teacher like that, and that when you wrote the story, it was with that teacher in mind.
Truthfully, I hated school. I hated it. Now, that doesn't mean I didn't do well in school. I did do well in school. I graduated fifth in my class. And, you know, I went on to get my undergraduate and a master's degree, which is school. And even my mother's like, you love school. I love learning. I hated school. I hated the structure of it. And if I think about favorite teachers, they don't show up until high school. And it was an English teacher who had the backbone in a small town to introduce us to true literature, true storytelling, you know, nothing, you know, things that would be banned books today. And if it weren't for her, I don't know that I would have ever known who I really was. I would have just gone through school and done the right thing and become a teacher, which I kind of wish I had done, but I didn't. But that would have been an honorable profession per my mother. My grandmothers were teachers. My aunt is an educator. Or I would have become something like a lawyer for the money. And if it weren't for that one teacher, yeah, I wouldn't be a writer. I know that. Her name was Mrs. Clark.
There you go. These were not stories that you sat down and wrote and that became the book. These are stories that have come to you and that you've written over the course of 30 years.
Yes, yes, exactly. When those stories come through, let me say that probably the corporate career stifled my writing. But yes, these are over the course of 30 years. The first story, 1968, I wrote in graduate school. It was part of a class. So that would have been in the 1990, maybe 91, that I wrote that one. Freeing Jesus was written in the mid-90s. And then many of the, what I called the parables, were written maybe 15 years ago when I was still at Bear Creek. And I was doing some freelancing, and there were oftentimes prompts would come through for just content, and I would write a story. And I took it seriously, and I would write a short story. So they sat around, and I had wanted to publish this many years ago and then just never got to it because the energy wasn't there from the day job sucking it away. And once I published Leadership Challenge, the middle management memoir, which I did write after being laid off, I thought about that collection of stories. And I'm like, I know how to do it. It's done. Why not go ahead and publish that as well? So I did. I put that out as well. And honestly, it's probably the one people prefer or like the most. I think they're intimidated by Leadership Challenge. They think it's a business book. And I'm just here to say it is not. It is, I would call it a corporate coming of age story. It's a memoir. So it's not businessy at all. But here I am, two books and currently working on another. I'm not sure if it's going to be a short story or a novel.
I will tell you that as I was reading, and I don't want to say the stories weren't complete because they were, but they also were intriguing in a way that I wanted to know more. I was like imagining what happened next for these people and what the reactions to them might have been. When you think about our own narrow little lives in the world, and then to imagine it was just food for thought, which is my favorite food. It also was a great read for a wintry night just to set, because they are short stories and it's a short book, but each one of the characters became someone in my mind, and I would like to know. So I'm hoping you will write a novel. I think having a full story would be a wonderful thing, coming from the pen of Christy Claxton.
Right. And I get that a lot. I want to know more when I write stories, but I think I write stories the way I write songs, because so many of my songs are really the same thing. They're short stories. Lost in Texas, short story. Juan is a short story. I mean, they are based on real people and these events, and songs are just quicker and easier to write for me than short stories. But I've thought about that, honestly. What if I took Lost in Texas and wrote a novel around that song? You know, so I'll keep writing. I plan on keep writing. I love it, and I may be begging on the streets, but I hope that I can continue to do this. I'm calling myself semi-retired because I turned 60 last month. So if I can stay out of the corporate world, I will, and I will keep writing. And, you know, I hope that people will keep reading. But yes, Freeing Jesus was meant to be a flight read. From, you could fly from New York to LA and read it. Or you could, honestly, you could fly from Austin to, I don't know, San Juan and read it.
A good couple of hours and to spend your time in other people's lives. I know that you're involved with several other things. You're still connected to Peace from the Porch and Porch Talk. So what are, I think you have a blog.
On ChristyClaxton.com, I do blog some, but I have moved more toward Porch Talk, which is a podcast, and you can catch it on Spotify, Porch Talk, a Peace from the Porch project. And for the most part, it's me and my dear friend, longtime songwriting and performing partner, Stacey Leader, in discussion. But I do bring other people in, and we're just having a conversation on the proverbial, to quote, porch about topics that are important, mostly to those of us who do not fit into cis white male, you know, and talking about the challenges of LGBTQ plus community, women, people of color, and the challenges we have. So, and then, you know, eventually, hopefully we get to more fun stuff too as well. It's pretty much anything goes. We've just sort of gotten into this, the challenges that people face in the workforce, because it's such a real thing right now with layoffs and the struggles that people are going through right now. But yeah, tonight, in fact, and I know that this is going to be post tonight when this airs, but Stacey and I are doing a live recording from Book Woman for Porch Talk, and we'll be encouraging audience to participate, to ask questions, to offer commentary. So we'll set up a microphone for the audience and record it. And it'll, I'm not sure how long, maybe I can do it fast, but the post-production is the hardest part of a podcast, but I'll get that up for people to hear. And what I'm hoping is that we're able to do that in many different places where, you know, me and someone else, but the podcast recording live from different venues, anywhere, Houston, Austin, LA, whatever. We want to do that. I want to do that because I want the community sense. I want people to be involved. And then also doing readings from the books as well. But yes, Porch Talk is on Spotify. So Porch Talk, A Piece from the Porch Project. If that's tricky, just ChristyClaxton.com. Everything is there. So people can get to my books. They can get to my to the podcast and any other writings and such that I've done.
Well, we've been talking with Christy Claxton about her book, Freeing Jesus and Other Lies. And you can check her out at ChristyClaxton.com and find out about her other Piece from the Porch projects. Thank you for being with us on Queer Voices.
Thank you, Deb. So great to talk to you.
This is Glenn from Queer Voices. You're listening to KPFT. That means you're already participating just by listening. But how about doing more? KPFT is totally listener-funded, which means it's people like you who are making donations who support this community resource. KPFT has no corporate or government strings-attached funding, which means we're free to program responsibly but without outside influence. Will you participate in KPFT financially? This station needs everyone who listens to chip in a few dollars to keep the station going because that's the way it works. Even if you're listening over the internet on another continent, you can still contribute. Please become an active member of the listener community by making a tax-deductible contribution. Please take a minute to visit kpft.org and click on the red Donate Now button. Thank you. This is KPFT 90.1 FM Houston, 89.5 FM Galveston, 91.9 FM Huntsville, and worldwide on the internet at kpft.org.
This is Brett Cullum, and here is your community calendar for February. February has a lot of theater going on, and one of the big ones is February 7th. The Catastrophic Theater presents Miss LaRaja's House of Dystopian Future. It's by the wildest author, Candace DeMesa. It opens at the Match on February 7th. It will run through March 1st. It is an entire cast of non-binary and trans actors, so you need to see this one. It is going to be the queerest of the queer as far as plays go this year. And speaking of gay theater, La Boheme at Houston Grand Opera. If you haven't seen this one yet, and according to my Facebook timeline, most of you have, they are having a Pride Night. It's going to be Sunday, February 9th. That is Houston Grand Opera's production of La Boheme, Sunday, February 9th. Tickets are half off. If you go to Outsmart, they have a code, and they are actually sponsoring this particular production. So thanks to Outsmart Magazine for saving us some money on these opera tickets. All right, this month we're talking galas, galas, galas. The first one up is Wags and Whiskers, which is a luncheon and pet fashion show where Ernie Manoos and Frank Billingsley are going to be honored as well. That's going to be held at Hotel Zaza on February 8th. Get ready for Wags and Whiskers. Also coming up February 15th, you know you can't go without celebrating Valentine's Day, and we have Project Love, which is a Valentine's fundraising gala. It is going to be at the Dow Academic Center in Lake Jackson, and it's going to star RuPaul's Drag Race star, Mistress Isabel Brooks from Houston. So if you want to catch her, that will be February 15th. Oh, and Chloe Ross is going to be performing with her as well. And of course, the big event, Friday, February 28th, the 72nd Diana Awards. Now, this time it's going to be held at Decorum at Poor Behavior. This year's beneficiary is out for education. So always a great time. You get to go to the Diana Awards, get some great first-class entertainment, some great food, a lot of jokes, a lot of great awards. And the Dianas is one of the oldest gay organizations in, well, the country. So definitely go out and support them. Friday, February 28th, the 72nd Diana Awards. And we will see you next month.
Multidisciplinary artist, writer, actor, activist, filmmaker, mother. It's so hard to pin down Candace DeMesa because when you think you got her, she just shifts again. In her own words, she uses theater performance, multiple literary genres, activism, dance, critical pedagogy, rituals, social practice, documentary, experimental, and short film. She uses textures that involve grief, world-building, science fiction, Afrofuturism, fantasy, spiritual technologies of African cosmologies to fashion what we call multidisciplinary experiences. We last saw Candace here in Houston, at least sort of virtually on film, and her most recent commissioned work, A Maroon's Guide to Time and Space, which had its world premiere performance run with the Catastrophic Theater May through June 2023 at the Match. It basically featured Harriet Tubman as a time-traveling DJ who took the audience on a wild ride few could ever forget. Well, she's back. And she's got a new production that opens on February 7th and runs through March 3rd called Miss LaRaja's House of Dystopian Futures. Once again, Catastrophic Theater is presenting this at the Match. So please welcome somebody that I just idolized to Queer Voices, the undefinable and completely free and liberated Candace DeMesa.
Hello. Hey. I love thinking about myself as free and liberated. I just need to tell my toddler that. Like she's.
Yeah. Well, I think that that's what your work has such a sense of. It's free of any kind of expectations or rules or anything. And you do make this collage out of theater. And I think that that's what people are really drawn to, especially with these productions, is that you just combine it all. It's wild. And very few people are doing this. How do you describe yourself? How do you describe yourself as an artist?
I mean, you know, I have like my artist bio, which is like, of course, you know, like the artist calling card for like the business side, you know, you have to write it up and make it sound great. But how I would describe myself as an artist is I am always looking at the world from this like spiritual lens, a very non-material lens. And I am in a really deep, committed relationship with inquiry and questions and soul searching. And so I feel like all of my art is trying to get to the root of why this group project of what it is to be human sucks so bad. Like, why does it suck? And I'm always thinking about like, what would it take for us to do better at this? And what would it take for us to be freer and more liberated together? I think about it constantly all day, all night, finding new ways to look at that question.
Well, second up, I wanted to ask you, we've got Miss LaRaja's House of Dystopian Futures. How do you describe that? Which is probably even a harder question.
Oh, my goodness. I think this is the weirdest thing I've ever done.
Oh, yay.
To date. It is so weird. And even me, as I was like reading what I wrote, I'm like, what is in that head? I don't know. You know, this project brought to you by being on the spectrum. So I think Mr. Rogers' House of Dystopian Futures imagines a world where humans have essentially like we are coming to an impending crisis. We're in the midst of a polycrisis right now with multiple wars, multiple environmental crises, multiple man-made environmental crises. And so it imagines that moment after all of these crises hit ahead, it explores what a world that decenters human supremacy would look like. It imagines what might plants, animals, mineral, like rocks, and the earth itself, what might they have to say to humans about what it is to exist here on this floating rock in space. It is done through some really amazing storytellers. All of our artists are queer or non-binary identifying. I think that's important because they are embodying these primordial essences of these biological entities, right? One, Miss LaRaj embodies earth. We have Miss Minnie, who embodies the mineral aspect, rocks, geological, massive canyons. We've got Phi, who is fire, Mommy Water, who is water. And we have flora and fauna. And then we have fungi, which is a digital character. So the show imagines what would it be like to teach humans what it is to exist through the eyes of all of these primordial entities and their song and dance and film. And it's really weird. It's so weird.
Oh, my gosh. I'm going to have so much fun trying to write this summary.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I struggle.
Well, let me ask you, just where did you come from? Where were you raised?
So I was raised in California, in Southern California.
Okay, this explains a lot.
Oh, it does. It really does. It really does. It like totally tracks. Yeah, I was raised in Southern California. My mother is African-American and my father is from Haiti. I grew up just like a Southern California baby and then moved to Texas when I was 25. About 25.
Why did you come here from Southern California?
Oh my God, the cost of living. That really, yeah. California, expensive. I couldn't do that anymore.
But what do you like about here? I mean, are you a fan of Houston? What is it that draws you here and makes you say, hey, I'm going to be an artist here in Houston?
I really owe all of my artistic development to Houston. Really. I don't think there is any artistic me without Houston. The seed was like nurtured in the seed was nurtured in Southern California, but as far as like the growth, I owe catastrophic theater a lot. Giving me my first like lead role in a show, especially that didn't specifically request for that character, like an African-American or Black actress, which was a struggle in Houston at the time. So that was like monumental for me.
Which show is that?
Oh, it was Buried Child.
Yes. Okay.
And they've really been a big part of like supporting all of my growth and expansion, which has been really, really important. But there's so many other like individuals and organizations in Houston that have really like trusted me and believed in me and helped me to grow. So Houston is a very special place as far as the arts ecosystem, the theater ecosystem. I don't know that people know that we have more theaters per capita than most of the U.S. This is a great network to throw your hand into. There are great artists here. And of course, we have a great like funding arts ecosystem here because of the oil revenue, right? Houston's very special and unique in terms of the amount of funding that's available. So I love Houston. I think Houston's a great art city. And I'm so excited that the nation recognizes that Houston's a powerhouse. We've got a lot of powerhouse artists of all genres that come out of here.
It's amazing. And I've definitely been a champion in the last couple of years and just looking at people that are coming from New York and LA and all these places saying that they're coming here because they have more freedom, that word again, to do what they want, a little bit less constrained by things like money and space.
Yes. Yeah. And
art for arts.
Yes.
So what was your educational background like? I know I was trying to read your biography. Tell us a little bit about what you kind of came up studying.
I went to Cal State Long Beach. Long Beach? Anyway, home of Snoop Dogg. And I initially studied theater. And then my junior year, I changed to Black Studies. And really it's because I found at the time as an actor, I was having a hard time embodying characters because I did not realize in my head the default human that I was trying to embody was white. And I couldn't be white. I didn't actually have as a neutral in my head, even myself, as a point of departure. And when I realized that what was happening in my brain, I changed to Black Studies because I wanted to know about that phenomenon. Like, how does this happen? Socially, what has been happening around this, where like the default human can be not you, and I could absorb that. How could I even have absorbed that? So that was where I learned all about social and economic relationships between race and class and gender and how that's manifested historically around the world, specifically in the United States. And then because I, always think of myself as somebody who like wants to change the world, I went and got a master's degree. At that time, I had one kid. I went and got a master's degree shortly after in public administration, thinking like, yeah, I'll do government work. You know, I'll do, yeah, I'll change the world. What a, you know, that was so cute. Oh, it was so cute. But I thought I would change the world that way. But it was actually really important for me because I learned about bureaucracy. I learned about systems and structures. I learned more about some of the impediments government to what we're dealing with as far as some of the limitations on our abilities to be free for damn near all of us. And I learned some systematic approaches that I still use to my art. I learned grant writing. I learned just very specific, important work around the administration of the art that I do that has been actually really critical. So it ended up working out, even though it's very different than what I thought I would be doing.
No, that's wild because most artists do not know how to get those grants or how to do the business side of the art. And without that to base, you know, to fund your project, you can't get anywhere. You know, you're just going to be in a cardboard box on a street corner going, hey, look at me.
Yeah.
Your work is so brilliant. I mean, it's like this collage. And when I saw your work at the Catastrophic last year, I mean, it was just this poetry. It was film. It was theater. It were these innovative sets. It was these wild costumes, this music. I mean, it was just everything. It was just thrown into this bucket. And it just, I felt like I'm just not in a piece of theater. I'm in a world all of a sudden. I'm in this entire environment and all of my senses are engaged and everything's coming at me and I'm seeing all these different forms of expression. How did you come up with this way of expressing yourself theatrically? Because it feels new.
So I don't have any formal training as far as like playwriting or things like that. I think that works in my favor because I do feel freer to just, I guess, do what I want. But as an actor, so I did prior to, you know, creating my own projects, you know, I did act all around the city and at the Alley Theater. So I did learn, I did have a lot of time looking at scripts and understanding text and understanding what, like, what good writing is, what good storytelling is. And then when I shifted into like multidisciplinary art outside of theater, then I was exposed to a whole new world where artists were could jump really far out into things I thought were like, this is weird and awkward and I feel uncomfortable. And there were so fewer limitations than the traditional theater that I cut my teeth in. And I really loved that and this opportunity to be free. And actually the project I first pitched to Catastrophic, that meeting did not go very well. I was nervous about jumping far. So I pitched them like a very safe traditional play. And I'm so grateful that maybe like 3 days later, I was like, I think I got scared and I think I'm settling. And they were like, yes, yes, we agree. And we love your work. And we want to encourage you to jump as far out as you want. That's what, you know, that's their theater. They support that. And so I had been thinking about Harriet Tubman as a time traveler for years, just like ruminating on this concept and thinking like, oh, Harriet Tubman saw a future and she saw like Black people free. And then one day I was like, well, I don't feel very free. So who did she see? And then that threw me on a whole nother, like, you know, yep. Portal of like, oh my God, she saw other people beside us. Who is she seeing? And like, how do I look? I'm looking at her. She's looking past me. I should be looking forward to the future. And yeah, it just, I had been thinking about it actually for some years. And then how that relates with Indigenous African spiritualities, where you learn you can't get anywhere into Indigenous African spiritualities and not hit some other entity who they say taught them what they know about essentially how to be human, how to organize societies. And I couldn't get around that. The skeptic in me always wants to be like, oh, eh. But I'm like, if you're going to honor Indigenous wisdom, and they say that they are not alone in the cosmos, that these other entities have come and helped them, then you have to consider that. And so I threw it all in a blender, like all these things I ruminate on. Like I said, shout out to Being on the Spectrum for the rumination and the, you know, these hyper fixations, space and Harriet Tubman. But I threw them all in a blender and that's the show that came out is Maroon's Guide, portals and dancing. And
I've been a theater critic for over a decade, which embarrasses me to even say now. And I have seen so many Black companies here in Houston, such as Ensemble, Vincent Victoria Presents, the Sankofa Collective, a whole bunch of people. And I don't feel like they're doing what you're doing. It feels like that they deal with kind of a cultural heritage. And they deal a lot with, for lack of a better word, the past or the present. And I feel like you, Candace, you're owning the future. And it's so cool to see that you actually are projecting this Afrofuturism that I don't even think I had a definition of that until I saw your show and started like deep diving. And of course, I did when I saw that Lovecraft Country series too. Oh, but shout out to Lovecraft Country on HBO. I wanted to ask, who are your influences? Like, who influenced you as an artist?
Lovecraft Country, I really loved. I think the writer is, oh, I know her. I think her last name is Naima Green. Yes. I love the show so much. I had to go look her up because I said, who did this? Who did this?
Misha Green.
Oh, what was it?
Misha Green.
Misha Green. Yes. Thank you. Misha Green. I love the work that her and the other writers in the room did for the show. And I think that was where I realized that I am a science fiction person. Yeah. And I hadn't really known that, but it made sense once I realized it. But I'm like, oh, this is who I am. This is what I do. The other show that really inspired me was Atlanta. Yeah, the show Atlanta, like just out how they just broke all the rules by the time you got to season four. It was just odd and disconnected story-wise. And I loved the freedom of that. I think those would probably be my biggest influences. There's another artist out of Houston that I, Autumn Knight, that has a very successful career. And I'm always just inspired by what to me feels like a thread of freedom in the work. And I am most inspired by, I'm very bored and uninterested in dealing with the past or the present. I'm uninterested. A big thrust of my work is that I don't want to tell oppression stories. There is no real path to freedom there. There's only telling someone else's narrative. And so if I'm going to create a lane for myself and the people I love to exist, I have to look at the future. I have to find that thread to place them safely. And so I don't deal with oppression. It's actually explicit in Maroon's Guide. It explicitly says there is no whiteness in the making of this piece. We're not escaping from slavery. We're not like Harriet is in a battle with no one, because I think if you make that the central conflict, it prioritizes again the system you're trying to subvert. So I don't do it as a practice. And it's the same with Miss LaRage's House of Dystopian Futures, which I call queer futurism now. I'm on a new thread, which is I want to decenter humans completely. Like everything that humans make and label, I don't want to decenter. What if we were not important anymore? You know, what if what we made, we looked at twice, three times? What if we trusted nature more than we trusted the human impulse to categorize? And I just feel like that's the freest way we can get. I keep my feet in the present, but I keep my heart and my head in the future.
Well, that's an amazing place to be, obviously. And another thing I wanted to ask you, and this is really banal, but what music do you listen to? Like if I go into a playlist of yours, what am I going to get?
That's a good question. Okay. I tend to listen to like the same bunch of things over and over. Okay. So when I was writing a Maroon's Guide, there is another Houston artist named Lee Harris. Mm-hmm. And I listened to one of her albums. I think it was called, it has something to do with Third Ward. It felt really scary to jump far out. And so I just wanted to listen to something that felt far out, you know, another artist jumping far out sonically, making interesting voice, you know, things with the voice and sound and exploring. And I wanted to feel free. So I would listen to that to kind of help me get out of my own mind, fear, and mind, blah, blah, blah. This one, I listened to Plantasia by Mort Garson. It is a strange, tinkly album. And the songs are like, oh, to an African violet. There's a song to a spider plant. I think it came out in the late 70s. And it's like weird, like synth music to plants.
I am so there. I'm going.
So good. And it, like, I just, yeah, it makes me think about plants. And I felt like it was really fun. So if I'm like creating, I kind of have to listen to something that feels like the mood of what I'm trying to live in, you know?
Yeah. You know, it's funny because when I first saw you and when I saw your video presentations in Maroon's Guide with you talking, I immediately went to Prince. And that is somebody that I grew up with, and I felt like he saw the future. It's hard for me to explain, but I felt like that when I went to a Prince show, there were no colors anymore. There were no boundaries. We all felt so free to be with each other. You reminded me just the way that you held yourself, the way that you spoke, the way that you seemed to come from the future. It just reminded me of this presence of this music giant that I worshipped growing up. But there's one other artist that if you get a chance to check out, there's a Swedish singer called Agnes.
Oh.
And she came out with an album called Magic Still Exists. And it's an album that you have to listen to from the very start to the end. You cannot skip around on the tracks because it is totally a lecture about being and existence and things like that. And I just thought, when I started listening to it, I was like, am I going to see Candace DeMesa pop up in here somewhere? So definitely. Magic Still Exists by Agnes. But now
I'm going to listen to it immediately after this. Like, immediately, and I'm going to email you.
We've gone off the rails so much, but that's expected because I'm talking to Candace DeMesa, Miss La Raja's House of Dystopian Futures, full of things like judgmental rocks and things, the earth coming to life. And I can't wait. And it's running at the Match Complex, starts February 7th, runs through March 3rd. One of the wonderful things about Catastrophic, tickets are pay what you can. You don't even have to pay like some exorbitant amount that they're going to set for you. You can absolutely do it. But from my experience, it's worth every penny that you can offer. I'm so thrilled to see you thriving and coming up on your second show. So I will be there just cheering. And thank you for coming on Queer Voices.
And it runs February 7th through March 1st. Okay. So can I briefly say, I am so excited about this show because it's my first foray into my new mental like fixation, which I'm labeling Queer Futures. And I'm sure that label exists, but I'm borrowing it. I really am loving, like, my idea of this queer future through this show is that a queer future is where we as humans position ourselves within the larger spectrum of all life, cosmic life, plants, animals. And what I really love and why it's so important to me that we have queer storytellers telling the story is that when we really position humans as part of nature, the things that we find divisive, right? Transphobia, there is no precedent for that in nature. There is no precedent for homophobia. There is no precedent. There's not even, I think from a natural lens, there wouldn't even be need for labeling because there is no opposing. All of these things exist so beautifully in nature as a function of an ecosystem of care. And I think humans, if we could really just get off ourselves as like we think, you know, being supreme, we could really find by looking at these interrelationships, ways that we could organize ourselves in our society that would really help us to get out of our own way in terms of how we're limiting empathy to each other. I love that because the future to me is us. When we rejoin plants, that future is queer. That future is so queer coded when we look at it. And my entrance into queer identity is through, I love the way that bell hooks terms it, which is like existing outside of racial, cis hetero patriarchal system, right? Just, I find my Black womanhood very much exists outside of a gender binary. Personally, I've never felt like I've had to exist in the gender binary that exists in like the white colonial imagination. There's been an expansiveness that's been afforded because my identity's always been at odds with every part of the society. And that's been, it was meant to be oppressive, but it's actually been very liberating because I was free from the get-go, if you really look at it. You know, these identities can be free from the get-go. I love that looking at plants and animals and as prophets, as teachers, as master teachers, really shows us that what we're grappling with is like biology, not even 101. It's the basis form. Nature done already figured out how to evolve to make sure that everybody fits. It had already figured that out like hundreds of millions of years ago. And we're still like on square one. And then also there's going to be very elaborate and flamboyant costumes. And there's a whole dance number again. And just getting roasted by nature, which I really just want to see humans get roasted, just get talked bad to. Plants and animals who are completely above and beyond the human definitions of gender and just look fabulous. It's like my dream right now.
It's a great dream to have right now because it does feel like such a scary time to be queer. I mean, it's really been a hard year. So we need Miss LaRaj more than ever. So yes, there you go.
To guide us all into, I just really hope to take all these communities that I love and I'm a part of that have named and claimed me and I name and claim. I really am. I feel like one by one, I'm just like trying to take us and deposit us into like a little homeland, do you know, a future homeland where in spite of what's happening socially, there is this like free place in the heart that we can hold, right? Like as a promised land. That's really, that's what I'm hoping. And I'm hoping that thread of like that feeling of promised land becomes infectious enough that once you feel it, you can't go backwards. You can't unfree once somebody's given you a space to be free.
Well, there you go. Artistic Harriet Tubman, Candace DeMeza. Let's go. Miss LaRaj's house is Dystopian Futures. Thank you.
Thank you.
We're here. And the colors of the rainbow surround you near. Oh, they will never win this fight. Cause we're stronger than we've ever been before.
Together, there's nothing we can't achieve, no matter your race or creed. We just gotta believe we are all survivors. We just gotta keep riding. They try to take our pride, but we just gotta keep fighting. The time is right now. No more talking about it. We more than just choreographers, stylists, and makeup artists. We are sons and daughters, rappers, doctors, and lawyers. And when we stand together, we'll be victorious.
Come on.
This has been Queer Voices, heard on KPFT Houston and as a podcast available from several podcasting sources. Check our webpage, queervoices.org, for more information. Queer Voices executive producer is Brian Levinka. Deborah Moncrief Bell is co-producer. Brett Cullum and David Mendoza Druzman are contributors, and Brett is also our webmaster. The News Wrap segment is part of another podcast called This Way Out, which is produced in Los Angeles.
Some of the material in this program has been edited to improve clarity and runtime. This program does not endorse any political views or animal species. Views, opinions, and endorsements are those of the participants and the organizations they represent. In case of death, please discontinue use and discard remaining products.
For Queer Voices, I'm Glenn Holt.
Now for your good news for a good planet. City Harvest. In a city as big as New York, there are a lot of hungry people, as well as a lot of food waste. So why not connect the two? That's exactly what City Harvest founder Helen Duverin-Palit decided to do. In 1982, she gave birth to the food rescue movement in America. Reaching out to local restaurants and grocery stores, Helen and a few volunteers borrowed cars and set up a hotline to redirect unspoiled surplus food to those most in need, single mothers, senior citizens, the homeless, and more. By 2023, City Harvest had grown from a single station wagon into a fleet of refrigerated trucks, a food rescue center, and an army of employees and volunteers that collect 200,000 pounds of food a day from thousands of restaurants and grocery stores. Cold produce, perishables nearing their sell-by dates, and overstocked items flow through City Harvest and out to hundreds of food pantries, farmers markets, and community agencies throughout the five boroughs, providing over 5,000 meals daily at no charge to anyone. Completely funded through donations, this nonprofit is now in a state-of-the-art campus in Brooklyn, doubling its capacity to feed hungry New Yorkers while culling food waste at the same time. And this is Mandy from GoodNewsGoodPlanet.com.
Good news, good planet, good news. Hi, this is Clint Broussard.